parsing a very bad speech. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
And Barry, as always, I'm glad to be with you here in the studio on our once-a-week foray into all things having to do with the church, politics, the world, you name it.
Well, we've got all that going on today because our main topic that we're going to be talking about right now is the thing that most people are talking about, and that is the speech that President Barack Obama gave this week on his rationale for why the U.S. should be involved in the Syria issue. Now, Chuck, unless you really do live under a rock or have been in a coma over the last couple of weeks, I think that the vast majority of folks know what we're talking about when we mention the word Syria and the administration's decisions on Syria.
I got to ask you a question about living under a rock. Is that spelled I-R-A-Q?
Oh, that's a good one. I hadn't thought of that. It may mean that before it's all said and done, but we'll get into that in a minute.
Yes.
But the president has been beating the war drum about Syria. Now, let's just be quite upfront about it from the get-go, okay? The country of Syria is set in a fairly strategic location in the Middle East. They have historically been aggressors to other nations, including and especially one of the U.S.'s, well, I usually call the U.S. the satellite state of this country, and that's Israel. And I think that's probably part of the reason why you have a number of, well, otherwise conservative members of Congress starting to get warm to the idea of the U.S. attacking Syria. Well, what happened? Well, Syria has been going through, let's say, an upheaval lately. They've had a change of government, and it's not been a quiet process as it usually is here in America. You know, we don't really have change of governments. We have change of caretakers of one government.
Yes.
That's been the beauty of this country is for the past 237 or so odd years, we've had one form of government. It's under the Constitution of the United States, but in many of these countries, when the caretaker changes, so does the form of government.
Well, yeah, but let's think about it this way. It passes from one dictator to another, essentially.
Right, or from one military junta to another,
yeah.
Depending on
And in this
is.
Case, it's passed from father to son. We've gone from one Assad to another Assad. And,
right.
And Assad has all, the Assad family has been in charge of Syria, oh gosh, what, since the 70s?
I believe that's the case.
We'll have to do a little research on that. It's sort of like this, you know, the military junta that was in charge of Libya until,
Muammar al-Qaddafi was killed.
He was in charge, I think, since 1979.
Right, and I believe like in the 80s, right, it was the famous line of sand, line in the sand quote. You know, this is the line in the sand, the line of death. You cross it, you die.
And yeah,
there was this famous skit, I believe, for maybe Saturday Night Live.
Where the
actor playing Reagan kept stepping across the line. He kept backing up. This is the line.
This is the new line. Do not cross this one.
cross it. But, you know, that's been the problem in the Middle East for hundreds of years. That is high instability, wavering back and forth between, well, mainly secularists, but then also Muslim leadership. And that's our big problem here in Syria. Well, the big issue that's got the world on edge, because Syria's been doing this, they've been going back and forth and fighting in internecine battles for as many years as we can remember. But this time around, all of a sudden now the world has discovered that Syria has chemical weapon ability. Why? Because one faction or the other, and it's still unclear
which faction. We don't know who.
Some say it's the ruling government faction. Some say it's the rebel faction. But one of those two factions decided they'd give a little test. and they released sarin gas on a civilian population and killed hundreds of Syrians in a chemical weapons attack. That got the attention of the world in a big way. And honestly, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't have, because, again, Syria has been an aggressor state for a long time, and the potentiality for that to become more than a civil war and for that to turn and become a threat or a rationale for the extended use of these chemical weapons on their neighbors, I think is very real. But it still raises the question of why the United States needs to jump into this in the way that the Barack Obama administration wants to jump into it.
And to illustrate that aggressor nation, let's talk about, just real quick, like the fact that, if everybody remembers the conflict that happened in Lebanon.
Yes.
Essentially, if you know your geography, this was a war of clients, if you will, in Lebanon. Syrian clients, clients of Iran, Saudi Arabia, and even some of the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union, was involved in many ways, against Israel. And it was essentially, that started out as a civil war, and it was between Muslim factions.
Yes.
Now, I'm not going to go into great detail here, first of all, because I don't completely, it's still a cloudy picture to me, and I've read about it umpteen thousand times.
Just remember the two factions, Sunni and Shiite.
Sunnis and Shiites, and that's exactly what it was about.
And honestly, in the American mind, those are probably interchangeable, except the way you pronounce them. But really, there are some significant differences between those two factions in the Muslim world.
Well, there was another factor involved in, and it was over the idea, too, that Lebanon was split between, in control of the government, between Christians, what were called Druze, which it's a Christian sect. It's more Coptic and maybe Eastern Orthodox.
Right.
Versus Muslim, and at one time the Christians were in the majority in Lebanon, and through a number of things, basically a much, much greater birth rate, the Muslims became the majority country, although by the constitution of Lebanon, the Christians held the majority of seats in their legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe they held the presidency or whatever the head of government was. So that was another part of the problem in Lebanon. That started that whole mess. I remember that started the year I graduated from high school. And I'm 56 years old. And that thing just recently came to what amounts to a halt. I think everybody who was going to be killed was killed. And mm-hmm. so they kind of brought it to an end. And plus the parties just basically said it's not worth any more of this bloodshed.
Right.
But the fact is that thing went on. We even sent troops for a time, if you recall, the Khobar Towers, where 286 Marines got blown up by a car bomb.
Right.
And it was we stuck our nose where it didn't belong, and we got it cut off. And we soon went home with our tail between our legs. It's one of the few really military failures you can point to under the Reagan administration. And I think they figured out that this was a fight that we really didn't understand and really didn't want to be part of.
And I think that kind of sums up probably the entire American experience in the Middle East. We don't understand it, but we want to be a part of it. At least that's what I'm seeing from the Obama administration, because we have spent quite a bit of time since August 21st, which was when the chemical weapons were detonated and actually killed over – I did a little fact check. It's over 1,400 Syrians, citizens. Well, ever since that time, Barack Obama – Secretary of State John Kerry and others have been talking about attacking Syria, pursuing military action against Syria. And I still have to ask myself, how many of those 1,400 were American citizens? Was this let off at the consulate? No, it wasn't. This is, although it's great concern that there are chemical weapons being utilized, the whole point is, at least in my mind, and maybe I'm thinking incorrectly about this, and I'm willing to be corrected if I am. But the point in my mind is, what direct threat, immediate threat, does any of this play on the United States itself?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer is none.
That's the conclusion that I have to come up with, unless you do think that Israel is a client state of the United States. If that's the case, then there's an issue as to whether or not this is considered to be more of a threat upon U.S. interests than it looks to be at this point in time. Now, granted, nobody wants any al-Qaeda forces or al-Nasri or anybody else to take over in Syria, but the point is the al-Assads are not that far of a stone's throw from it. So.
I'm going to disagree with you that nobody does.
Okay.
Because, let's take, for instance, Libya and Egypt as an example. Because right? Let's be clear about everybody knows about the Benghazi scandal. A lot of people don't know where Benghazi is. It is in Libya.
It's in Libya, that's
so
right.
So basically we've just shown that attacking a consulate and killing the ambassador really doesn't mean anything if the president of the United States, A, is looking to get reelected, B, trying to recapture Congress,
mm-hmm.
and C, is in support of the people who killed the ambassador and three other Americans. And let's look at that conflict really, really closely. The Muslim Brotherhood, who are they? And we were in support of the Muslim Brotherhood in taking over the government of Libya.
Right.
Who are the Muslim Brotherhood? Well, the fact is that they are kissing cousins, if not kissing brother and sisters. My studio audience didn't care for that. We have a studio audience today, folks, and that little analogy kind of disgusted her. So that's good. We have a canary in the coal mine here.
That's right.
But the fact is that they are kissing cousins with al-Qaeda.
Yes, that's true.
They are the same people. Now, the rebels in Syria, even John Kerry has come out and said, now, where he got this number, nobody knows. And he's not saying, but he's saying, well, they're 15 to 25% quote unquote Muslim radicals. That's Muslim Brotherhood. And that is al-Qaeda.
Yes, it is.
Now, here we are. We're fighting Taliban, which is al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. We've just finished up, basically gone home with our tail between our legs from Iraq.
Yes.
That was
al-Qaeda in Iraq.
And in Iraq. And now we're supporting them in Libya and Egypt, which is really a black eye on. Now, the Egyptians are basically fighting back and saying, we don't want these clowns.
Well, that shows that they've got a lot more sense than we do.
And if you'll notice that things are deathly silent from the White House about really what's going on in Egypt. If you'll remember, the ex-president Mubarak was in prison, that the Muslim Brotherhood had thrown him in prison and for some reason hadn't executed him yet. I guess they were waiting to do a show trial or something. And now he's been released because the Muslim Brotherhood's almost out of power. And again, remember, these guys are al-Qaeda. They're not necessarily members of al-Qaeda, but they are closely allied. They share funds. They share secrets. They share common members. It's sort of like if you think about it.
Walks like a duck, talks like a duck, and looks like a duck. It must be...
It's something.
No. Well, according to our foreign policy, it must be a
turkey.
Moose.
Yeah, or
it must be a moose.
It's not even a bird. It's a moose. That's it. So let's look at this from that perspective. Does someone want Al Qaeda to win in Syria? Not under that name.
No, not under that name.
They want them to win under a different guise, if you will, moniker. They want them to win under the guise of something. And they really aren't necessarily, they wouldn't like them to necessarily win under the name the Brotherhood. They want them to be something else. So that's why we're getting this speech about 15 to 25% radicals. Barry, in that kind of a situation, who ends up in the leadership positions? It's the Muslim radicals. Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
This is not too hard to gauge. This is, okay, let me talk in terms historically about the Russian Revolution. Were the, you realize that you've all heard the phrases Bolsheviks, Mensheviks. Menshevik means basically the majority party. Bolshevik means the minority party. And in both cases, those two factions together were, if they reached 10% of the people of Russia, it would be a shock. They were more like 1%. But who ended up in power after the revolution? The people got stirred up, they got used, but the leadership were the Bolsheviks.
Bolsheviks, that's right.
So who ends up in power? The Bolsheviks. We're looking at the same thing in Syria. Yeah, okay, 15 to 25%. They're the leadership. They're going to end up be who ends up in charge if Assad gets thrown out, which now it looks less and less likely. And one of the reasons it looks less and less likely is because of this muddle of a speech.
Yes.
Had Congress acted early on in this thing, we would basically have already been involved. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if, A, we wouldn't have been bombing and sending cruise missiles over. We would have been talking about putting boots on the ground.
Yes, we would have been.
Now it's looking less and less and less likely, and the reason is nobody knows for sure who released the gas.
That's right. And that, and it doesn't seem like either side is taking credit or denying credit for
well,
that.
Well, there's a great possibility that, A, it could have been captured stocks that were opened accidentally. Which side really wanted to gas anybody? Knowing full well that it would bring the wrath of the United States and probably Western Europe down on their head. Now, there's an interesting thing about this in that it's turning out that Britain, 6 years ago, sent a cargo of sarin gas to Assad in Syria.
What a surprise.
And does it not shock, or I'm not shocked by the fact that Britain said, uh-uh. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. When the United States came to them and said, we want you, your support in going into Syria. And they're like, we don't want anything to do with this because they know who's going to get blamed for distributing the sarin gas in the first place.
Well, of course.
And they also have bad memories of the whole debacle 2001 through when did we pull out of Iraq finally, 2010.
I believe so, yes.
You know, the whole nine-year mess that basically brought down the Blair government because it became clear that their victory was not achievable.
Now, it's interesting, Chuck, because what it's coming down to now is the United Nations, that august body, has put boots on the ground, so to speak, in Syria because they've been investigating the sarin gas attack. And supposedly, according to a post in Foreign Policy on their website, that the UN report will point to the government of Bashar al-Assad as responsible for releasing this gas. Now, that raises, again, those same specters that you raised, and I think it's part of the reason why the Brits and others are just not wanting to play right now. Now, if that's the case, the question then goes to the issue of, does that then turn to creating a recall of Assad in Syria? I mean, will they push for that? The opposition forces, or will this just intensify the fighting there and call for another response from the international community?
Well, let's take a deeper look. You know, we've already talked about the Brotherhood. Why are we supporting these governments being turned over to the what amounts to the Islamic radicals in all these countries? Well, Barry, who are they replacing? As much as nasty as Assad and Saddam Hussein and Hosni Mubarak and Muammar al-Qaddafi and a number of these governments are, were all members of the Ba'athist Party.
Yes.
This is one of the things that a lot of people don't understand, and the term has been spread around for years about these Ba'athists. Nobody knows what the Ba'athists are except the people who have taken the time to sit down and do the research about what the Ba'athist Party is. The Ba'athist Party is a pan-Arab secularist party. In other words, they want to run a secular government in which all the Arab countries come together in sort of a pan-Arab partnership.
A pan-Arab union.
Yes, a pan-Arab union. That was the goal behind the Ba'athist Party. And one of their biggest enemies, a lot of people don't understand this. When we went into the Iraq War, people kept conflating Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda.
And, those were two entirely different animals.
Very different animals. In fact, Saddam Hussein was on the Al-Qaeda death list because he was a secularist.
And he had spent his entire career in his regime keeping the Sunnis and the Shiites at arm's length from everybody else and providing a safe space for Christians.
Exactly.
In Iraq.
He was running protection for the Christians in Iraq, keeping both the Sunnis and the Shiites away from them.
Now don't mistake us. We're not saying that Saddam Hussein was a Christian. He was a secularist. But he was a secularist that realized that it did him no good to allow either one of the Muslim religious factions to get strong enough to do anything.
That's right. And he, of course, being an Iraqi, they are majority Sunni.
Yes.
And he leaned toward the Sunnis, but that's what the whole Iran-Iraq war was about, if you recall that debacle.
Yes, because Iran is majority
Shiite. Yes. And if you don't understand what that is, we're not going to go into detail on that. It depends
on their view of the second coming of the Mahdi.
Well, it really amounts to which one of Muhammad's sons-in-law that you follow as the follow-up leader after he died. It's the Sunnis and the Shiites, and they've been at each other's throats since the late 600s. So this is not a new conflict. Now, the thing about this whole idea of the secularism is that, okay, what these leaders were going to do was not discourage the practice of any religion, but make sure that it was separated out from the running of the government in order to facilitate this pan-Arab union. Because they understood that you were going to have to keep both those factions quiet in order for this to work. So what they did was they suppressed all that infighting. And Gaddafi was successful in keeping it quiet, although I think Libya is mostly Sunni. Remember, in Egypt has a very large Christian population, or had one until the Brotherhood took over. Then, of course, they basically went through, force converted a bunch of people. The Coptic Church was who most of the Christians were in Egypt. And, of course, they have dwindled down to a precious few. There are almost no Christians left in Iraq anymore. And in Syria, they're rapidly declining.
Yes.
In Lebanon, they're being oppressed. Because that's essentially, Lebanon is basically a Syrian client state at this point, with a buffer zone with Israel, if you know your geography. And what's happening is that a lot of people don't understand, Christians are being wiped out in the Middle East. Flat out.
In alarming numbers.
And it's being done because Muslim radicals are taking these positions of power. Now, I'm not going to come out and state directly that the President of the United States, but why is he supporting Muslim radicals in these states that were formerly secularist, and when we're supposedly fighting a war in Afghanistan against the same guys, and we were fighting a war in Iraq against the same guys? So what's the deal?
I do believe, Chuck, that's probably something that maybe if we listen to the president defend the reasons why he thinks we should start attacking in Syria, maybe we'll get a kernel of why he's supporting those whom it doesn't seem like on any pass it would be logical to be supporting.
Well, we're going to play this thing, and then we're going to stop it when we think it needs to be stopped and comment. Okay, so here we go.
My fellow Americans. Tonight I want to talk to you.
Stop it right there. Stop it right there. I just wanted to give a shout out to the birthers. No, let's go on.
About Syria. Why it matters and where we go from here. Over the past 2 years, what began as a series of peaceful protests against the repressive regime of Bashar al-Assad has turned into a brutal civil war.
Okay, there's the first problem. Does the United States of America involve itself in civil wars?
Well, the constitutional answer would be no, but the pragmatic answer of this administration is all the time.
Let's define what a civil war is. It's a war between at least two factions and maybe more for control of a central government.
That are both indigenous to that country.
To that region, right.
Over 100,000 people have been killed. Millions have fled the country. In that time, America has worked with allies to provide humanitarian support to help the moderate.
Okay, do we have a problem with humanitarian support?
No.
No. That's food, clothes, medicine, bandages, even Doctors Without Borders and that kind of stuff that go in and provide medical care. Great idea.
Right. Well, you know, that kind of reminds me of a little joke that I saw floating around the blogosphere. Supposedly an article by John Cleese, and he talked about, you know, the Americans and the threat levels and said, we have two threat levels, arm the missiles and fire the missiles and send bandages. And so maybe to Barack Obama, humanitarian effort was arming the missiles and send bandages.
Apparently, yeah.
And the rest of it goes next.
Opposition and to shape a political settlement. But I have resisted calls for military action because we...
Okay, no, he hasn't. He has not resisted. He is chomping at the bit to go to use military action. The fact is that we, the people, have resisted calls for military action. This
the
is the bottom.
Is, who's been calling for the military action? That's the question that needs to be asked.
And it has been. All you have to do is listen to any speech given by John Kerry, the Secretary of State, over the last 3 weeks.
Yes. Well, and Kerry's done a fantastic job lately of opening mouth and inserting foot.
Or feet.
Or both feet.
Yes.
We cannot resolve someone else's civil war through force, particularly after a decade of...
But wait a minute. Isn't that exactly the policy that he was pursuing, was we need to attack Syria?
Yeah.
He just said it's a civil war, and he's just saying we can't solve somebody else's issues in a civil war by force, but yet now he's saying... We must go in and attack Syria.
Yes, our studio audience says, these are not the droids you're looking for. Okay, we're about to get the explanation, though.
Yeah, but this is called the farce, not the force.
Right, right. May the farce be with you. We're about to get an argument, and then once he makes it, I'm going to stop and tell you what it's called.
Sure.
War in Iraq and Afghanistan. The situation profoundly changed, though, on August 21st, when Assad's government gassed to death over 1,000 people, including hundreds of children. The images from this massacre are sickening. Men, women, children lying in rows, killed by poison gas. Others foaming at the mouth, gasping for breath. A father clutching his dead children, imploring them to get up and walk. On that terrible night, the world saw in gruesome detail the terrible nature of chemical weapons and why the overwhelming majority of humanity has declared them off limits, a crime against humanity, and a violation of the laws of war.
Okay, here's what we heard. He stated unequivocally that the government of Syria had done this. Okay, that's not a proven point. But what did we hear? Children foaming at the mouth, parents attempting to rise their dead children. This is called waving the bloody shirt.
Yes, it is.
What he's done is he's painted a graphic picture of, he's made a statement at the front where he basically said, the government did this, and even though it's a civil war, all the civilized nations in the world have outlawed the use of this gas, then how come Britain had it to send to Syria 6 years ago, and how come we have stocks of it? But the matter is, we've waved the bloody shirt, and we've created an emotional appeal. Dead kids, dead women,
Now, and just so nobody who's listening to us gets us wrong, it isn't that we're uncaring or unfeeling about this. This is a human tragedy.
Right.
Okay? This is something that should make you sick to your stomach. It should make you feel queasy and sad and maybe not despondent because we know where our hope comes from. But the point is that when it's now being used as a base political propaganda tool, honestly, I'm almost more queasy about that than I am about the issue of how of the people who actually got killed. What he's trying to say is this gives us an excuse to go do whatever we feel like. And yes, that's dangerous.
And that's exactly what he is seeking, a blank check.
Yes.
On the basis that women and children were killed. Well, let me ask you a question. How many civilians did we end up killing in Iraq?
You're not supposed to ask that question, Chuck.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you it's large. It's well over 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
It's well over 100,000. It's around 1 million, if I'm not mistaken. The fact is, this is doing what's called waving the bloody shirt, and it's creating an emotional appeal rather than a logical appeal, because we just heard the logical appeal. It's like we don't get involved in other people's civil wars. The fact is, he can't prove that Syria did it, but he's going to say that because the logical conclusion is we must do something about it.
This was not always the case. In World War I, American GIs were among the many thousands killed by deadly gas in the trenches of Europe. In World War II, the Nazis used gas to inflict the horror of the Holocaust.
Okay, here we go. We're evoking these images. And, of course, the Nazis did use cyanide gas,
yes,
to murder Jews.
They did.
And everybody used gas in World War I.
Mustard gas, yes.
Except the Americans. Right. I don't believe we used gas shells, although the British used them on our behalf. But in any case, these horrible things happened. Again, we don't know who used the gas. And even if we did know who used the gas, I would ask this question. Are those kids any more dead than they would have been had bombs, mortars, rifle bullets, other things been used against them than they are with the use of the gas?
Well, I mean, it really gets down to the point that, yeah, you're not going to change what happened. Regardless of the method used, you're not going to change
right.
what happened. The question is that remains, and honestly, it really gets down to the next largest question. Is the United States' role policeman of the world? That's honestly the underlying question of this. Now, the Obama administration, I think, believes the answer to that question is an unmitigated yes. I don't believe that the vast majority of the American public, nor the majority of the members of Congress, believe that to be the case.
And the real question is, here's what the argument we're going to get. Oh, you guys are isolationist.
No, not isolationist. But the point is that unless you can show that there is a direct impact yeah. on American citizens or on direct American interests, then I don't believe you have a legitimate case for saying, look at what they did to each other. We're going to go over there and attack them.
Yeah. I always say in reply to that, I said, no, I'm not an isolationist because isolationism implies that I don't want to have diplomatic relations. No.
Right.
Trade and diplomacy for all, and you use your trade as a lever. War is a last resort. As von Clausewitz said, war is politics by other means. I don't think we've exhausted all the other means yet.
Because these weapons can kill on a mass scale, with no distinction between soldier and infant, the civilized world has spent a century working to ban them.
Which side is not discriminating against soldier and infant? Neither side.
Neither side.
Again, I asked the question, bullets, bombs, mortars, what's the difference? The fact is, this is a civil war, and civil wars tend to get particularly nasty.
And in 1997, the United States Senate overwhelmingly approved an international agreement prohibiting the use of chemical weapons, now joined by 189 governments that represent 98% of humanity. On August 21st, these basic rules were violated, along with our sense of common humanity. No one disputes that chemical weapons were used in Syria. The world saw thousands of videos, cell phone pictures, and social media accounts from the attack. And humanitarian organizations told stories of hospitals packed with people who had symptoms of poison gas. Moreover, we know the Assad regime was responsible.
Oh, no, we don't. There are numerous reports of possibility that the Assad regime was not responsible, and who inside the Assad regime was responsible. Remember, we're in a situation here that is in flux.
That is entirely true.
There are factions inside the Syrian military. How do we know that this was not a rogue faction that didn't decide to do this? How do we know that it was, automatically blaming the Assad regime for something?
Because we must take Barack Obama's word for it.
Yes. We know next to nothing about this. All we know is it was released. And you'll notice that he's reiterating the fact that there is no doubt that chemical weapons were released. We're not disputing that. We're disputing the idea that we know who did it.
Yes.
In the days leading up to August 21st, we know that Assad's chemical weapons personnel prepared for an attack near an area where they mix sarin gas. They distributed gas masks to their troops. Then they fired rockets from a regime-controlled area into 11 neighborhoods that the regime has been trying to wipe clear of opposition forces. Shortly after those rockets landed, the gas spread, and hospitals filled with the dying and the wounded. We know senior figures in Assad's military machine reviewed the results of the attack.
I have seen no reports to indicate that's true. Now, that doesn't mean they're not out there. It just means it's something that I haven't been able to find.
Well, that's because the president gets a higher level of classified information than we do.
Well, why would that be classified if you're trying to sell the idea that we need to go to war over it?
Oops. Well, maybe you found the Achilles heel.
The flaw in the logic, yeah. If you were trying to sell it, wouldn't you release that stuff and make it readily available?
You might think.
And the regime increased their shelling of the same neighborhoods in the days that followed. We've also studied samples of blood and hair from people at the site that tested positive for sarin. When dictators commit atrocities, they depend upon the world to look the other way until those horrifying pictures fade from memory. But these things...
You mean like in Libya?
Oops.
You mean like in Egypt?
Possibly, yes.
How about any number of African despots who are basically killing Christians, starving them to death, force converting them? We don't want to talk about that. Cutting heads off if they refuse to convert. Name it. This is selective enforcement at best.
Happened. The facts cannot be denied. The question now is what the United States of America and the international community is prepared to do about it. Because what happened to those people, to those children, is not only a violation of international law, it's also a danger to our security.
How so?
I haven't been able to figure that out.
Okay, that's the question we've been asking all along. It's a threat to our security. Don't think so. What's a threat to our security is going in to a place going off half-cocked and creating what is known in the parlance. You'd be well aware of it if you read the 9/11 report. Blowback.
Yes.
Because what you do is you end up making one faction or another angry enough to infiltrate our borders, which, by the way, is really easy. And if you don't believe that, here we are arguing over whether we're going to allow illegals who have simply walked across the border at unprotected spots citizenship or a path to citizenship. That's a tacit acknowledgement that our borders are porous and there's nothing to stop people from posing as illegal migrants and coming across the border because nobody's checking up on them.
No, they're not.
Let me explain why. If we fail to act, the Assad regime will see no reason to stop using chemical weapons. As the ban against these weapons erodes, other tyrants will have no reason to think twice about acquiring poison gas and using them.
Okay, this point has already been checkmated because Putin has agreed to take possession of Assad's stocks of chemical weapons.
And quietly slip the ones that are marked sent from Russia back into his own
That's
stocks
right.
so we don't get the smoking gun effect.
Yeah, so essentially Assad has said, this leads me to think possibly that Assad's like going, hey, look, I'm getting, this is a bum rap. I don't want these things. Because I really don't need to be dealing with American cruise missiles.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, our troops would again face the prospect of chemical warfare on the battlefield. And it could be easier for terrorist organizations to obtain these weapons and to use them to attack civilians.
Hold on here. This is doublespeak writ large. How are the terrorist groups going to get them when the terrorist groups are who's fighting Assad for control of the government of Syria? If we're going to go in there and aid the overthrow, because that's what it's going to be. It's going to be about, they're saying it's not about regime change. It is. And who are we going to change to? We're going to change over to the rebels, who we've already explained are Al-Qaeda, who are going to come in possession of these quote-unquote weapons of mass destruction. That's how they're going to get a hold of them.
Yeah.
These people don't have any compunction. Apparently, Assad does. You know, we can talk about rockets being fired into areas and all this stuff. Show me the money and show me the proof. But the fact is, you're basically going in and you're going to overturn one bad guy and put in another bad guy. And that doesn't work for me. We've already tried that, replacing one bad guy with another bad guy. And basically what you end up doing is making enemies out of all the bad guys. Well, we've never been overly friendly with Assad, but we're going to end up being friendly for a time, at least with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Again, the old saying, politics makes strange bedfellows.
Yeah.
It has a more ominous tone than now.
Yes.
If fighting spills beyond Syria's borders, these weapons could threaten allies like Turkey, Jordan, and Israel. And a failure to stand against the use of chemical weapons would weaken prohibitions against other weapons of mass destruction and embolden Assad's ally, Iran, which must decide whether to ignore international law by building a nuclear weapon or to take a more peaceful path. This is not a world we should accept. This is what's at stake. And that is why, after careful deliberation, I determined that it is in the national security interests of the United States to respond to the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons through a targeted military strike. The purpose of this strike would be to deter Assad from using chemical weapons, to degrade his regime's ability to use them, and to make clear to the world that we will not tolerate their use. That's my judgment as Commander-in-Chief. But I'm also the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy.
Oops.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the education classroom here, Mr. Obama. I believe that Common Core is probably going to be teaching that, Chuck, in social studies. But it's not true. We are not the world's oldest constitutional democracy. Obviously, Obama has never bothered to read any of the founders who all basically stated in shall we say, very revealing terms what they really felt about democracy.
Yeah. Well, yes.
And things that we show people and teach in our Institute on the Constitution course. So
we are a republic, ladies and gentlemen, not a democracy.
Amen.
So even though I possess the authority to order military strikes.
No, you don't.
Yeah, I was going to say, where does he get that particular authority in the Constitution, Chuck? I don't remember that being in there.
Now, I'll be quite honest. We have a friend down at American Vision who has a different idea about that. He says, Joel McDermott wrote a piece and basically said, yeah, unfortunately, Obama's right about that because of the commander-in-chief role. And I tend to disagree with that, and I'll tell you why. Because we'll post a link to his article, by the way, so you can read it for yourself. I tend to disagree because the president is not given commander-in-chief roles so he can go around starting wars.
No.
And then have Congress come in later and declare it. It's that role is there to deal with
Well, you're getting back
like invasion.
Well, you're getting up to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. That's what we're going right. to do with this, or where Barack Obama's going to. He's taking that whole idea that he can do any action he wants to do as long as within 60 days he lets Congress know about
right.
it. That's not what the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was for either. And by the way, in that particular instance, in that situation, it was a direct attack on American troops.
Well, it turned out to be not a direct attack on American troops, but
right, exactly. but at least you had the appearance of
yeah.
it actually being a direct and legitimate interest to the United States.
It's interesting you bring that up, because when you look at the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, what did they do? It was all based on supposed radar
yes.
pickups of these PT boats that were closing in to do this attack.
Yep.
And they never proved any of it. In fact, it came out much later that it was all phantom shadow echoes and that kind of thing. Probably what they found was a fleet of fishing boats that was in the middle of the Gulf of Tonkin. And that's exactly what we're kind of looking at here. Now, we know that the gas was used. We don't know who used it. We don't know under what circumstances it was used, and we don't know why it was used. But here we've got it being stated unequivocally that it was Assad and he knew what was happening and blah, blah, blah. Okay.
I believed it was right, in the absence of a direct or imminent threat to our security, to take this debate to Congress. I believe our democracy is stronger when the president acts with the support of Congress. And I believe that America acts more effectively abroad when we stand together.
Okay. What he's saying is here, I want to do this, but I know I'm going to get my head handed to me
mm-hmm.
in the press and in public opinion if I don't. And I don't want to end up being called the next Jimmy Carter. So I want congressional approval to do it. But I have the right to do it, but our democracy is stronger if I do it this way.
Yep.
That's the bottom line here. This is what makes this speech such a muddle. Okay, look, if you're going to go off and claim the War Powers Act as your absolute right,
that's right,
which we dispute, then do it. Do your 60 days worth of why should it take more than 60 days to destroy Syria's stock of chemical weapons? It shouldn't. And you know, shut up and do it. But the fact is that he doesn't want to get the PR black eye. So here he is making an appeal, and a very muddled appeal.
This is especially true after a decade that put more and more war-making power in the hands of the president and more burdens on the shoulders of our troops while sidelining the people's representatives from the critical decisions about when we use force.
Okay, smoke and mirror show, folks.
There it is.
The fact is, yes, has the president concentrated more power in his hands? Yes. Is it constitutional? No. Were the troops put in jeopardy over this fight? Yes. But the fact is that Congress could have reined them in at any time. Simply cut off the funds and tell them to bring the boys home. Commander-in-Chief, the people who really run the military are telling you, bring them home. And they didn't do that. So he's playing with the facts here.
Now, I know that after the terrible toll of Iraq and Afghanistan, the idea of any military action, no matter how limited, is not going to be popular. After all, I've spent 4.5 years working to end wars, not to start them. Our troops are out of Iraq. Our troops are coming home from Afghanistan. And I know Americans want all of us in Washington, especially me, to concentrate on the task of building our nation here at home, putting people back to work, educating our kids, growing our middle class. It's no wonder, then, that you're asking hard questions. So let me answer some of the most important questions that I've heard from members of Congress and that I've read in letters that you've sent to me. First, many of you have asked, won't this put us on a slippery slope to another war? One man wrote to me that we are still recovering from our involvement in Iraq. A veteran put it more bluntly, this nation is sick and tired of war. My answer is simple. I will not put American boots on the ground in Syria. I will not pursue an open-ended action like Iraq or Afghanistan. I will not pursue a prolonged air campaign like Libya or Kosovo. This would be a targeted strike to achieve a clear objective.
Where have we heard that before?
Well, first of all, where's the target and what's the objective?
Yeah.
Now, he said it's to get al-Assad to stop using chemical weapons. Okay. Does he mean to stop using them in Syria and start using them on U.S. soil? Is that what he's talking about? Because that's really probably, if you start attacking a sovereign power because you want to be the big boy on the block and tell everybody else what to do, don't be surprised when somebody turns around and pops you in the nose.
Yeah. And the way you, a little kid strikes at a bully is by surprise in a vulnerable spot.
Yes.
Because you don't go toe to toe with him. You hit him where he's not prepared, and then you run away and you hit him again when he's not prepared again. So that's kind of what we're setting ourselves up for here.
Deterring the use of chemical weapons and degrading Assad's capabilities. Others have asked whether it's worth acting if we don't take out Assad. As some members of Congress have said, there's no point in simply doing a pinprick strike in Syria. Let me make something clear. The United States military doesn't do pinpricks. Even a limited strike will send a message to Assad that no other nation can deliver. I don't think we should remove another dictator with force. We learned from Iraq that doing so makes us responsible for all that comes next. But a targeted strike can make Assad or any other dictator think twice before using chemical weapons.
Okay, again, how? If someone, some faction in his government decides to use it without him, this makes it sound as if that Assad is an autocrat. And all autocrats are by nature prisoners of their bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, because one man cannot do everything. And this is Barack Obama, you know, the man who really does think he can do everything, showing his true colors here. He is demonstrating the idea that he thinks one man can't control everything. One man can't. And especially as the situation grows more and more and more chaotic, especially with the United States military strikes, you're actually more likely to create a situation where more of this could happen.
Oh, absolutely.
As the more radicalized factions come to the fore and say, we've got to do something to strike back. So we've seen it before. This is nothing new. This is the same old bad idea.
Other questions involve the dangers of retaliation. We don't dismiss any threats, but the Assad regime does not have the ability to seriously threaten our military.
And the famous last words. No, the military is not who should feel threatened. It's us.
Yes.
Here in the United States of America, remember, the U.S. military had nothing to do with bringing down the World Trade Towers or crashing a plane into the Pentagon.
That's right.
Any other retaliation they might seek is in line with threats that we face every day. Neither Assad nor his allies have any interest in escalation that would lead to his demise. And our ally, Israel, can defend itself with overwhelming force, as well as the unshakable support of the United States of America. Many of you have asked a broader question. Why should we get involved at all in a place that's so complicated and where, as one person wrote to me, those who come after Assad may be enemies of human rights? It's true that some of Assad's opponents are extremists, but Al-Qaeda will only draw strength in a more chaotic Syria if people there see the world doing nothing to prevent innocent civilians from being gassed to death.
Okay. Wrong.
You got it.
That's an absurd statement. They'll only gain more strength if they see us doing nothing. No, they will gain great strength, as we saw in Iraq and in Afghanistan, when they see us doing something. And as that situation grows more chaotic, if we're involved, guess what? The Great Satan becomes the target. Everybody rallies around the guys who know what to do about the Great Satan. This is liberal fantasy land. This is the kind of fantasy land use of surgical military strikes. And these guys over and over and over have attempted it, and over and over and over it has failed miserably.
The majority of the Syrian people and the Syrian opposition we work with just want to live in peace, with dignity and freedom. And the day after any military action, we would redouble our efforts to achieve a political solution that strengthens those who reject the forces of tyranny and extremism. Finally, many of you have asked, why not leave this to other countries or seek solutions short of force? As several people wrote to me, we should not be the world's policeman. I agree. And I have a deeply held preference for peaceful solutions. Over the last 2 years, my administration has tried diplomacy and sanctions, warnings and negotiations. But chemical weapons were still used by the Assad regime.
Okay, this is simply a lie. Flat out. Basically, we have aided and abetted Muslim radicals taking over in Libya, in Egypt. We've essentially looked the other way as they have gained control of Iraq.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is just simply a bald-faced lie. Now, whether he's been attempting to negotiate, he's been attempting to negotiate Assad out of office. And Assad is basically saying, no, I'm not leaving. And this is nothing more or less than his way of attempting to potentiate regime change while making it look like he's not potentiating regime change. Yes, and nobody's buying it. That's why this speech, this was supposed to be the big game changer. As you can see, why this speech is not a game changer. Now, we're going to run out of time before we get through the whole speech. But I think you'll get, in the last couple of minutes here, the gist. I think you will have gotten the gist of what we mean.
However, over the last few days, we've seen some encouraging signs. In part because of the credible threat of U.S. military action, as well as constructive talks that I had with President Putin, the Russian government has indicated a willingness to join with the international community.
Okay, Putin is saying, no, this was my idea. We did not discuss this at any kind of meeting. And now all of a sudden we're going to hear, we need to do military strikes, even though the Russians are now getting prepared to take the chemical weapons out of his hands.
Right.
Isn't that what we were looking for?
I thought that was where we were heading, but maybe not.
In pushing Assad to give up his chemical weapons, the Assad regime has now admitted that it has these weapons, and even...
He didn't need to admit it. We already knew he had them.
Everybody knew he had them.
It was no secret.
Said they joined the Chemical Weapons Convention, which prohibits their use. It's too early to tell whether this offer will succeed. And any agreement must verify that the Assad regime keeps its commitments. But this initiative has the potential to remove the threat of chemical weapons without the use of force, particularly because Russia is one of Assad's strongest allies. I have therefore asked the leaders of Congress to postpone a vote to authorize the use of force while we pursue this diplomatic path. I'm sending...
No, he hasn't. We're going to...
Well, let's just give him credit. I mean, come on. You know, regardless of what he said, none of what he said made any difference because Congress didn't move any closer to wanting to allow him to take a military role in Syria than they did before he gave this
speech. That's right. In fact, it's further away than it was before this speech.
As a matter of fact, I thought it was funny, Chuck, and this is just kind of a quick aside. The one thing that this did generate was a great laugh for me as I listened yesterday. I was flipping through the radio dials as I was on the highway getting some windshield time, and I heard Sean Hannity having a disagreement with Congressman Peter King from New York, because you see, King supports Obama, yeah, and Hannity can't understand why. But it was so funny listening to two neocons having that moment when they realize that their entire philosophy
is bankrupt.
It's bankrupt.
Yeah.
and that all it takes is a little push like this to get them to split and polarize. Now, problem is, let's hope the conservatives don't do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, that being said, we are out of time. That's not the whole speech, but it's about 12 minutes of a 15-minute speech, and that's the gist of it. I think we've done a pretty good job of essentially analyzing the major problems that exist in the speech and why this did not do the job that the president had hoped it would do. All I can ask is that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.